This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we check in with Sue Balcom for Main Street Eats as she shares some recipe ideas for your Labor Day and lets us know about some fun food festivals coming up across the state during the month of September. We are going to start talking about food, talking about gardens, and talking about how in a garden you can grow more than food, you can grow community. Jack Wood is here. He is the founder of the Growing Together Community Gardens, and he was recently awarded a $5,000 the Magic Hero Award. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Do you know the reason that you were nominated for the award?
Well, the reason I was nominated by Becky Erickson, who mm-hmm. was a long-time volunteer at Growing Together.
Okay.
And in the past year, her husband's had some problems, so she hasn't been able to come to the garden. But she nominated me, and there were over 1,200 people that were nominated for this award.
Oh, that must feel pretty good to be narrowed down out of 1,200. That's a lot of people.
Yep.
Yeah, well, good for you. What did it feel like when you found out that you were going to get this and have an extra $5,000 to do what you do?
Yeah. So, well, the first time they called and they said they had gotten down to like five applicants and they were just interviewing them. And I thought, well, I'll never win. And then a month later, then they said, you have won and we want the marketing director from Paris, France to talk to you too. So then we talked. And then also as part of the award, they flew in a team from New York City and from LA to do a video interview that they're going to release on their behalf, but they're also going to let us use it for our promotional purposes.
Wow. That's going to be amazing. Let's talk about how Growing Together Community Gardens works. You have eight gardens now in various different locations, and primarily it's aimed at helping new Americans establish?
Yeah, basically it's new Americans, but it's also the community. Anybody that lives in Fargo-Moorhead or close to it that can come to the garden. One of the things we do with the garden, there is a minimum requirement of 16 hours to be a volunteer. In our early years, we'd have gardeners, then all of a sudden when we started to harvest, then all these new people would come,
right.
And which was
little
not really
hen.
Fair for the people that put in all the work. So right now we have a minimum requirement, and that works really well.
Yeah. How many volunteers are you working with?
We are probably working with close to 150 volunteers in the different gardens.
Wow. And how does that compare with when you started? That was back in—
Well, when we started in 2006, we had eight families, and we started in a garden that was like 100 by 100. So definitely we have dramatically grown, and it seems like each year we have developed partnerships with different people. So like two of our gardens are in Fargo Parks. Okay. We're starting a brand new garden at the Kissimmee Cathedral. We also have gardens at various churches. We had a garden at the former LSS building.
The Lutheran Social
yeah.
Services? Okay. When it comes to gardening and working with a population of new Americans and then people who have been here for a while and locals, is there any talk of different ways to use these ingredients? I might have grown up only eating cucumbers one way, and then somebody else might say, well, have you tried having them spicy, for example?
Well, I think one of the different things is not many people ate eggplants, and now everybody loves eggplants. But also some of the new Americans didn't like certain things like kohlrabi and beets. And now, you know, so it's worked both ways.
Yeah. Do you have meals ever that are about learning about cultures and food?
In the beginning, when our garden started, we would have a prepared meal every single week.
Oof.
And now it has sort of evolved more to gardening. And we have an occasional potluck where people can bring foods together.
Okay. Why did you want to start this community building from the perspective of a garden?
Well, I think what we thought that a universal language is gardening, and basically a lot of universal foods, especially like tomatoes and cucumbers, are loved by everybody around the world. So it was really a good way to start working with the new Americans. And the first new Americans were from Africa. A lot mm-hmm. of them were from Liberia. And then as we started working more with like Lutheran social services, a lot of residents of Bhutan had come in.
Okay.
And so then it sort of changed our flavor just a little bit. But it's pretty incredible the amount of produce that's taken home each week.
Yeah. How much?
So between 20 and 30 pounds each family.
Wow.
So it's bags and bags. And one of the things is, in the beginning, we provided transportation. We no longer do that. But normally what happens is, as the new Americans that walk to the garden usually get rides home from volunteers that have cars.
What have you learned about this idea, this sense of being an American, that you learned from new Americans?
Well, one thing we learned from new Americans, they were very happy to be in the United States and to not be persecuted. The majority of all of the new Americans that resettled are because of wars, whether it's Liberia, Bhutan was basically ethnic cleansing.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we'll have, you know, some people from Afghanistan coming in. People feel very safe in the United States, and where you can walk down the street, you don't have to worry about, you know, coming home to your loved ones.
How is working in a garden and volunteering and growing food and teaching other people how to grow food? If I'm not mistaken, this is faith-based for you, right?
Yeah, it started as faith-based, but now we have people from all faiths. So
right.
We have Buddhist and Hindu and Baptist and Catholics.
So how is it an expression of your faith to do service?
I think the expression, especially with all of our core volunteers, I think they see how we give in the community, and they want to do the same thing.
Hmm. Have you learned about other religions yourself in this process?
A little bit. So we do garden with the Church of the Latter-day Saints,
okay.
And they send a lot of their missionaries. So the boys have to have 24 months of service, and the young ladies have to have 18 months. And they do talk to us about the Book of Mormon and a little bit about that. And then I think, you know, with different cultures, you know, some don't eat meat, some do different things. If we work with, like, the Muslims, they have Ramadan. And so we learn about those different things.
Mm-hmm. We're visiting today with Jack Wood, the founder of Growing Together Community Gardens. He was recently honored with the RCA Magic Hero Award. This means there will be $5,000 going towards the community gardens. What kind of difference does $5,000 make for Growing Together Community Gardens?
So a huge difference. As we look at all of our volunteers basically volunteer for free.
Mm-hmm.
We do have expenses. We have to buy, you know, the different insurances, which are fairly expensive. But then we have like the tools and the seeds and different things. It definitely does add up. But one of the things that we have been able to do is our input costs are fairly low. Like 3 years ago, our gardens produced 65,000 pounds and our input cost was like right around $6,500. So
wow.
For basically 10 cents a pound. So it's a great return.
Yeah, you can barely breathe for 10 cents. You said insurance costs. What kind of insurance do you need for this?
So basically we have liability insurance, so just in case anything ever happened. And then also because we're a 501c3, we have our board is covered. So if something did happen, that we would be covered. And in this day and age, insurance is so important.
Mm-hmm. So, Jack, you are the name in town when it comes to tomatoes. What do you love about tomatoes?
Well, probably like 20 years ago, I started planting tomatoes and started saving seeds. And I bought this book. It's called 100 Heirlooms for the American Garden. It was written by Carolyn Mayle. And from there, I started gathering different seeds. Right now, personally, I have over 250 varieties. So one thing we started last year that some of the community members might be interested in, it's called the Tomatoes Seed Saving Club. And what we do is we have a garden that we have 100 varieties, 4 plants of each. And we save seeds from them. And the people that volunteer with us will have access to our seed library. And they also will be able to, once we have harvested the amount of seeds that we need, all of the balance of the seeds will be donated to the community or to our Seed Savers members.
That's awesome. Where does your mind go when you're gardening?
Well, I think what happens when we are gardening, so basically every garden has a lead, and then within our garden, we have what we call garden leaders. And we probably have, in most of our gardens, like 6 to 8 garden leaders, and then they lead smaller task groups. Mm-hmm. And so basically, when I'm in the garden, all I'm thinking about is making sure that everybody is engaged and no one is bored. So I really don't have time to think about everything. But one of the things as leaders, we're thinking about, what are we going to do next week? How are we going to clean up the garden? What are we going to do with the excess food? And, you know, different things like that.
Okay. So you don't get to be one of those people who goes out into the garden instead of, for example, going to a therapist. Or, you know, it's not a meditation. It's a business.
No, and what I will do sometimes is I will come to the garden like 1 or 2 hours early and just prune tomatoes because that's my favorite thing to do. And all of our tomatoes are – each individual tomato is individually staked and is individually pruned. So it does take a little bit of work.
Yeah. Well, that pruning tomato thing, it's a delicate balance, right?
Yep. It's very much of an art. And, like, we can train pruners. And so the following week, I think they might forget what they're supposed to do.
Right,
and sometimes they'll cut the leaves off on the plant, which what they need to be doing is pruning the side shoots and take, you know, and basically you need the leaves to produce the tomato. You can't cut off all the leaves.
Right, but you want to get that branch that's kind of going towards the ground at the bottom, right?
And then we basically, so any branch that touches the ground, we take that off. Also right now what we're doing is any new flower is being taken off the tomato because at the end of the year that will be a green tomato.
Okay.
And yes, you want some green tomatoes, but not very many.
And you have your own way of planting a tomato. I showed up once at a volunteer garden opportunity, and I'm sure 80% of people there said, well, this is how Jack would do it. And it involved a trench, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple different things that we have done. One thing we have done in our tomato seed saving, which was a new concept, we have 4 plants planted 24 inches apart, and in the center we have a small hole that we dug. So what we do each week is we fill that hole with water, and that waters all 4 plants.
Okay. Did you come up with that system?
I did. I don't know. It might have been one of our other members. I can't remember for sure. But it's pretty incredible where in our gardens our tomatoes are probably like 4 feet tall, and in the tomato seed saving they're like 5 feet tall, and they're just absolutely loaded with fruit, especially this year because it's been so dry.
Yeah, it is. Has been not too bad for tomatoes, I think.
Yeah.
I noticed on the website growingtogetherfm.org that you have garden starting toolkits and that there's a partnership with food pantries. And food pantries, I'm always interested in this, you know, fresh food tends to be the healthiest, but it's also the hardest to manage when you are dealing with bulk amounts and trying to get them out to populations that already tend to have less access to healthy food, less knowledge about healthy food, or even just fewer tools and space to be able to prepare the healthy food. So what is your approach to getting good, healthy food to the populations that need it most?
Well, we have a couple different things. Number one is when you pick up produce in our garden, it's fresh. It's been just picked. The other thing, we do have a market garden that a lot of the people on the south side visit each week. The one thing that when you go to your food pantries, a lot of the food there is excess maybe that wasn't sold in the store, but a lot of it is like past the date.
Mm-hmm.
So basically it's going to spoil fairly fast.
Yeah. I just put some vinegar on that usually and just call it a pickled, whatever it is. You said a market garden. Is there opportunity for making money for some of the people that you're serving?
Well, one of the things we do is basically the market garden is to pay for all of the expenses of the community. One thing that we do is basically if you work at our garden for your share, you get a voucher that you can use at our market garden too.
Okay. Are you aware of this style of community service? Are there places across the state that are doing this?
Not really. Basically, everybody that has started a community garden in Fargo has worked with Growing Together. We do have a mentor program that their leaders can come to each week, and we work with them. We have been contacted by some of the local places to help them with startups. A couple of different things we did this year is we worked with Island Park Gardens. So this was started with one of our interns and then also one of our garden leaders. We also worked last year with the Congregational Church, which started a garden, and their leader comes to us. We helped the Carlson Library get their little garden started.
Okay. A lot of the partnerships that you're mentioning, churches and I think you said the parks department. I'm wondering, I always sit and drive around or bike around and you see so much green space, especially in areas that have been flood buyouts around the Red River. Is there work to be done that you are doing at all on this larger scale working with cities? And I know it's easier to work with small organizations.
So presently we are not. We were contacted by Harwood that was working on doing like a park. And we've worked with some of the different people up at NDSU to maybe start gardens. And we're definitely always open to come and discuss. And then definitely we have access to our garden toolkit, which really helps out.
What is that garden toolkit?
So basically the garden toolkit tells you everything that you need for the garden. And there's talking about the leadership aspect, talking about you definitely need land, you need water,
and
a tool shed is definitely much of a benefit. Then other than that, we have information about seed sources. We have information about some of the different gardening techniques. One of the gardening techniques that really has propelled our gardens is we do raised beds. And right now we've gotten up like an inch 75 this morning, and so like 5 years ago, basically all of our gardens would be underwater.
Mm-hmm.
Today, basically, because of the raised beds, all of the veggies are above the ground, and in between where the path is, there the water is, and the water will sink down, which develops a better place for the roots to go.
Sue Balcom, who's coming up in the second half of this show, is a farmer's market grower out in the Bismarck-Mandan area. And she mentioned that it's been difficult to get seeds for people who are doing this for a living, in large part because of the pandemic, as more people are returning to the home garden. Has the pandemic impacted your ability to do your service work?
Well, one thing, because we save seeds, we don't have as much of an issue.
You got that.
But one thing we did notice, like we wanted to buy like delicata squash,
mm-hmm.
and I went on like Johnny Seeds, and basically it was all gone. And so in certain different things, if you're looking for something in particular, definitely you want to order early. You don't want to wait like a month before and then try to order.
Jack Wood, the founder of Growing Together Community Gardens and recent recipient of the RCA Magic Hero Award. You can find out more at growingtogetherfm.org. Jack, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Natural North Dakota is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, now accepting applications for the Bush Fellowship through September 9th. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Bismarck State College and the National Endowment for the Arts present the Dakota Bison Symposium, September 16th through the 18th in Bismarck. Learn all about the American bison and their rich Native and North Dakota history during this dynamic three-day event featuring film, culinary art, dancing, presentations, and more. Registration and more information can be found online at bscdakotabison.com. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thorberg. And the Baltimore Orioles get all the attention, but there are other Orioles. And no, I'm not talking about baseball. I am actually talking about Orioles, the birds. In this week's Natural North Dakota, biologist Chuck Lura introduces us to other species of Orioles.
A friend recently told me all about the Baltimore Orioles they had been observing, complete with a cell phone picture of the Oriole feeding on half an orange at their feeder. Most everyone's familiar with the Baltimore Oriole, but it might surprise you that North Dakota has three species of Orioles. The Baltimore Oriole and the Orchard Oriole range over much of the state. The Orchard Oriole is darker, with orange being less prominent. The Bullock's Oriole may be found southwest of the Missouri River. It's a chunkier Oriole with a brighter coloration. And unlike the Baltimore Oriole, which has a dark head, the Bullock's head is orange with a black cap and eye stripe. Baltimore Orioles utilize habitats of open woodland and small groves of trees, as well as parks, backyards, and the like. It's interesting to note that one of their winter habitats are the coffee and cocoa plantations of Central America. Ornithologist Arthur Cleveland Bent described the song of the Baltimore Oriole in his Life Histories of Familiar North American Birds as, and I quote, "the softest, sweetest voice of all our birds," unquote. The Oriole's song is somewhat reminiscent to that of a robin, but more liquid, sweet, and pure. And, of course, who among us has not been intrigued by the sight of an Oriole nest? How do they make that hanging nest of various fibric materials? That material may include such things as grasses, hair, wool, string, thread, twine, and the like. It seems like nimble fingers and an opposable thumb and well-developed brain would be prerequisites for such a construction. No doubt many among us think the Baltimore Oriole is named after the city in Maryland. However, Cornell University's All About Birds website notes the Baltimore Oriole is so named because the coloration of the Oriole, bright orange and black, is similar to the coloration of England's Baltimore family crest. So be on the lookout for Baltimore Orioles in your area, and keep your ears open to their interesting song. And if you really want to see and hear them, put out a nectar feeder, half an orange, and some grape jelly. You'll be richly rewarded. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
Hi, Peter Sagal here, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Prairie Public is celebrating 40 years of radio, and they have invited me to zoom in on the party to play Not Dave's Job with news director Dave Thompson. Did I say yes? Of course I did. Zooming. It's fun. Join us Saturday, September 25th at the Radisson in Bismarck. Get your tickets at prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-6900. Congratulations, Dave and Prairie Public, for 40 outstanding years serving the great people of North Dakota.
Still to come on Main Street, a preview of the upcoming episode of The Great American Folk Show. But first, this news.
Good afternoon from the Prairie Public Newsroom. I'm Todd McDonald. One more North Dakotan has passed away with COVID-19. According to the State Health Department's coronavirus dashboard, the statewide death toll is now 1,562. 535 new individuals from 43 counties have also tested positive. Today's results are from a batch of 8,383 tests for a daily positivity rate of 6.7%. There are currently 2,763 active confirmed cases statewide. 95 new cases were found in Burleigh County, 83 in Cass County, and 52 in Stark County. A detailed map of all new cases from each county is posted on our news page at news.prairiepublic.org. North Dakota's Mineral Resources Director says the shutdown of oil imports in the Gulf Coast could mean a boost to the Bakken, both in terms of barrels shipped and oil price. Lynn Helm says Hurricane Ida shut down between 15% and 20% of the country's oil production, and it stopped tanker traffic. He says the refiners there could be looking for crude oil supply.
Demand is up for crude oil being produced in other places like the Bakken. Haven't seen that in the crude oil price yet, but we do expect over the next couple of weeks that that'll start to build into the pricing.
The Dakota Access Pipeline runs from North Dakota to Patoka, Illinois. It connects there to a pipeline that serves Louisiana and Texas. Helm says the pipeline now carries 750 barrels per day, and he says the pipeline is full.
We also have rail capacity that can go there, and in the past, almost all our rail capacity has been going west to the west coast. But that could shift, and so we could see another 100,000, 150,000 barrels a day shift onto rail to go to the Gulf Coast to try to alleviate the problem.
And Helm says that could make a dent.
Current imports into Gulf Coast refineries run around 1.5 million barrels a day, so that'd be a 10% knock off of what's shut down at this point.
Helm says it's likely we'll see higher prices at the pump as well. And the North Dakota Public Service Commission has approved the transfer of permits dealing with the Coal Creek Station power plant near Underwood from Great River Energy to Bismarck-based Rainbow Energy Center, LLC. One of the permits deals with a water line bringing Missouri River water to the plant. The other concerns a high-voltage direct current power line that runs from Coal Creek to Buffalo, Minnesota. A subsidiary of Rainbow, Nexus Line, LLC, will own that power line. Great River was going to shut down the plant in 2022 if a buyer could not be found. For Prairie Public, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Not Stock is an annual live interactive arts event on the campus of Minot State University. And there are a few off-campus businesses around the Magic City that also participate. Festival goers experience poetry, printmaking, digital arts, theater, and music. It's been going on since 2007, except for a pandemic pause last year when it was a virtual opportunity. In this feature from Sunday's Great American Folk Show, Tom Brousseau chats with Knotstock founders Lori Geller, Vice President for Academic Affairs at Minot State University, and art professor Bill Harbort.
My recollection of how I met Lori was a hallway conversation about poster artists. I knew that Lori was a poster collector and, again, teaching graphic design. I met someone on campus that knew a lot of great illustrators and great designers, and we had a good conversation about the history of poster design. I think we were talking about, like, psychedelic posters early on.
The Art of Rock 1960s. Book.
Yeah.
2006, we got together and wrote an intellectual climate committee grant. There was a little committee on campus that had some funds to help bring something that would enhance the intellectual climate on campus. And yes. So that's where I got connected to him.
We put wonderful, talented poster artist Jay Ryan in here, just screen printing live. Mm-hmm. And that really set the tone for the event for the next 14 or 15 years.
That first year was really just him and a few bands, and he made a print especially for others to help him with. We had a whole line of students just lined up ready to pull the squeegee.
And you saw kind of the promise of what it was that came together. And was that in 2007?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
And then at that time, did you have the idea of Knotstock, or how did that all come about then when he finally said, let's do this again, and if we're going to do it again, we need a name for it? Was that literally the next year, in 2008?
That was the next year. We came up with the name Knotstock. Mm-hmm. I guess it's a portmanteau, which is a fancy word. It's kind of a combo term word. We took the kind of Minot mantra, which is part of the Knotstock, and we also referenced Flatstock, a music poster fest.
What's your connections with the posters from the past?
I think the imagery, the use of typography and illustration, they make the event memorable and intriguing. They act as, in some cases, souvenirs. Many of those posters from the 60s are highly collectible now and sought after, and they serve as memory. And in some cases, they suggest maybe the feeling or the emotional quality of the music. I know Lori has connection to posters and is a collector.
I came to this just through my interest in music. During the 90s, I was one of those Pearl Jam fan club members, and Scott still got the little fan club thing in the mail, not all on the internet yet, and realized they were selling these posters through the fan club. And so I bought one of these, and I was like, wow, these aren't just put through this Xerox machine. And so kind of fell in love with that, and then realized that the two that were making most of these posters for Pearl Jam were the Ames brothers, and they were from Havre, Montana. And posters are unique in that they're not very expensive. So I can buy a piece of art that somebody's hands have touched and have made through this process that costs maybe $20.
You've been on this journey. You met each other in a hallway here on the campus of Minot State University. You had a dream, and you started this festival, Knotstock. And it's been happening every year since. And this is what year? It didn't happen last year.
This would be the 14th year.
The 14th year that it's happened.
14th year, yeah. And it's blossomed. It started with a simple idea, a poster artist in a student union area to engage students, to make students aware of this art form. And it's really grown into an arts festival, say ARTS. Mm-hmm. And this year is like many other recent years, and this just keeps getting bigger and bigger, including more of the arts.
So what else has been added to it over the years?
It was always kind of this synergy between art and music, and has since went into spoken word. I'm not sure when we started spoken word.
2010, I want to say.
Yeah.
And that was really the year I think we added probably the most variety or additional types of art was that year. So adding spoken word, poetry, sometimes more traditional poetry or writing as well, depending on the guests that we ask to participate.
Yep.
We've added ceramics, so we will have wheels for anyone to come sit at, and somebody can help you learn how to throw if you've never done it before, as well as we've had raku outside. So we've filled trash cans with fire and and lots of smoke and pull something beautiful out of it, or you don't always know what you're going to pull out of it.
We have an art exhibit this year that's in tandem with our criminal justice department. So the art department got together with criminal justice, and essentially we curated a show in tandem with the North Dakota Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Last year was the first time that we put this show together called Visions of Justice, and incarcerated people from all over the state either painted images or wrote poems. Mm-hmm. And those were displayed in our gallery. This year we have a show as part of Knotstock. It's called Quarantine. Incarcerated people all over the state are making works about being quarantined with COVID and in a confined space with COVID. And I'm really curious to see what type of visual solutions and what type of poetry comes with this show.
What can one expect this year?
Yeah, we've got three different printers coming. Max Mon, who is in Missoula, Montana, who goes by Twin Home Prints. Joe Triscari of Moonlight Speed Press, who's in Denver, Colorado, will also be coming up here to work with him. Then we also have Ben Blount from Chicago, who is a letterpress. He can also do screen print, but he is primarily a letterpress artist. So he will be here. He does a lot of work in activism and social justice that he can share. I know he's doing a big mural right now in downtown Evanston, Illinois, mm-hmm. where he's from, and putting up things that are meaningful, relevant to all of the conversations we're having around the country about race and social justice. There's also Tama Smith, who is North Dakota, from down in Beach, North Dakota, who will be here as a potter. Joe Davis, who is one of our Minot State alums, who will be back to lead us in some poetry and some of his performance poetry. He also sometimes puts that to music as well. And then, of course, you are going to join us as well this year, so we're excited for that.
Plastic arrangements, you sure they keep your colors through the cold.
Really delighted that we're able to do it this year. And it's an honor to be asked to come and be a part of the fun here at Minot State University.
It's been a journey for sure.
Yeah.
It's been a journey, and the event has really shaped itself in a unique way.
There are hundreds of high school kids that come in for the event on Thursday and Friday. I remember the first year there was a busload from Sydney, Montana that came in and sat with Jay Ryan on the floor, and he explained the whole printmaking process to all of them. They come from Williston, they come from Rugby, they kind of this whole region, and it helps those kids see something that they may have never been exposed to had they not come here.
And when they come here to Knotstock and they see all these arts and they can, it's participatory. I mean, you can participate if you want to. That's inspiring.
Yeah.
And it gives hope to, you know, up-and-comers that they can do the same thing. All they need to do is get busy.
Yeah. We hope they leave the event and they have that inspiration, like, I can do this. I can screen print out of my garage, right? I can play music. I don't need to rely on, I'm going to just do this, right? You hope they leave with that verve and that inspiration to say something.
We like to say it's a live, hands-in, hands-on event.
Well, this year's Knotstock will be taking place Thursday, Friday, Saturday, September 23rd, 24th, and 25th.
Correct.
And it's on the campus of Minot State University. I want to thank you both for being on the Great American Folk Show, Bill Harbort and Laura Geller. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you for being here.
That was singer-songwriter Tom Brosseau talking with Laura Geller and Bill Harbort, organizers of Knotstock, a hands-in, hands-on arts festival on the campus of Minot State University and at various venues around town. Also on the upcoming Great American Folk Show this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central, we'll have more Minot with children's book author and musician Max Patzner. Plus, a couple who composed music for poems of the beloved children's author, Margaret Wise Brown. Sue Balcom is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas, Director of Radio at Prairie Public, and today, Director of Thankfulness. Wednesday was the 40th anniversary of the first radio broadcast by Prairie Public, and it was one of our best fundraising days ever, matching the $10,000 grant from Jeff and Mindy Glickman. It is my glad duty to thank all of you who contributed. If you missed your chance, you can always go to prairiepublic.org. Thanks again to our Wednesday donors. What a great anniversary.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Doug Hamilton is on medical leave. Once a week, we check in with Sue Balcom. We call her Root Cellar Sue. She joins us from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellar's farm. Sue, thanks for joining us for Main Street Eats.
Oh, thanks for having me, because as you know, there's nothing I like better than food except talking about it.
Two great arts coming together.
I know. And we do good together. You know, we kind of have this generational thing
we
covered.
Get off topic.
Way young over here and I'm way old over here, and there's all this stuff in between our lives that kind of like comes together over food. It's awesome.
Do you have any big plans for your Labor Day weekend?
Oh, heck no. Let me think now. What am I doing over Labor Day weekend? Oh,
I'm planning
yes.
on hiking the Matahay Trail.
Oh, you're kidding. That would be so awesome, but you got to watch for rattlesnakes. I know you know that.
Yes, I do know that, because I almost stepped on one once.
Me too. The last time I was at a photo workshop with Pat Gerlach in the Badlands, and I'm walking along a trail, and I put my hiking boot down, and I looked, and right there is a rattlesnake, like an inch over, and that thing would have been under my boot, and it would have been a bad thing.
Thanks. Well, speaking of never getting off topic for Main Street Eats.
Right. No, we don't eat rattlesnake. Do we? Do you eat rattlesnake?
I never have. No, okay. I'm sure that it's done, but
I heard it tastes like chicken.
They always say that. Everything always tastes like chicken. But Labor Day is, of course, a time that people get together
and eat.
You know, we celebrate the end of summer. We celebrate the end of this or
the beginning
of
school,
the harvest.
Yep,
getting those kids back out of our way, et cetera. And then, of course, you know, the fact that there's a lot of work. There's a lot of labor involved with being alive, and we recognize those achievements of those hardworking people, including ourselves, at times anyway, you and me.
well, and working for food, that's a pretty labor-intensive way to earn a living, let me tell you. But, you know, I come from the land of, I wish I could say this in German. There's a German saying, and my grandmother actually said this to me one time when I was at her house. She's like, you know, work makes life sweet. And so we celebrate the ability and the freedom to work at the jobs that we have.
You know, the French have a saying that the French work to live and Americans live to work.
Right, because I think we take less vacation time than any other country.
A lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And I got to change that. But, I learned something really cool about food in foreign country here at a conference that I was at just recently. And the word is sagre. And they have bunches of sagres in Italy because they totally love to eat and they totally love their food and they celebrate their food. You know, like they have tomato festivals or they have pastrami festivals or, you know, they have regional foods that are specific to, you know, the type of food and the region that it comes from. And you can't fake it, you know, like I can't grow a San Marais tomato and say that it comes from Italy because it was grown in the United States and we have different soil and we have different customs. But I think we should do more celebrating over food that we eat.
So what is on your Labor Day picnic?
Let me see here now. I think I heard a rumor that my brother was going to make Niffla soup for me and my dad because he can't eat anything that's too tough to chew. Mm. And that is like an atypical Labor Day weekend food. But
yeah,
it
usually
is,
it's kind of like
barbecue
on the grill.
Yeah,
right?
Brisket on the grill. And who knows? I find that because I grow so much food and can so much food for sale at farmers markets, it's like the cobbler's kids has no shoes kind of thing, you know, that we don't eat almost all the time. We kind of like have hot dogs on paper plates some nights because I'm too tired. but one of the things that I think we don't do here in the States is spend a lot of time normally, like a holiday. Everybody gets together on Labor Day and they do some grilling. I know my son has, I think the big thing in grilling now is those black stones or whatever they're called, kind of things, and they do stir fry on them and hibachi type foods. And he's quite a good little cook, I must say. I raised him well. but why do we only do this on Labor Day and Memorial Day and Easter and Christmas? We should be getting together with our friends and family and making mealtime like 4 hours or so on a Sunday. I mean, what better way to, you know, sit around and learn about your friends? And I knew a family in Gackle when I was in college or shortly after college, and we went to her house for Easter dinner. And it started at noon, and we didn't leave for college till about 4 o'clock that day because we sat around the table and we had a meal, and there were two meats and a bunch of salads and some great desserts. We just spent the whole afternoon there enjoying our food and our company.
Yeah, when I lived in France after college, my lunch break was 2 hours, maybe even 2.5.
Ooh, did it include a little 20-minute nap by any chance?
Yeah, right?
We are so doing this stuff wrong here. Oh, shoot. And they do have festivals, you know, in the United States. They have, you know, rib cook-offs and chili cook-offs and the best barbecue sauce and stuff like that. And believe it or not, I found 3 food festivals just in September alone in North Dakota. And, you know, if you're a small town and you have nothing else to do, why not have a food festival?
Why not have a lot of food?
Yeah. And we are good at growing things in North Dakota.
That's true, yeah.
Next weekend, I believe it'd be next weekend, September 11th, in this little town called Taylor, North Dakota, which is out west this way, they have a smoke show for pork ribs and butts. And so I'm sure that as part of this competition, there'll be a winner, but there'll also be tons and tons of food for sampling or just enjoying a good tasty pork dinner and maybe some games and fun stuff like that. I love these festivals in these little towns. These people are so welcoming, and it's just a lot of fun. There's not a lot of houses or places to stay, so you may want to plan ahead if you're going to drive all the way to Taylor,
right?
Which is close to Richardton, just for reference anyway.
Right, which is a little bit west of Bismarck, just off of I-94,
right? Right. Okay. Or somewhere east of Dickinson. I guess it depends on how you look at it, Ashley.
Good to know.
And then, of course, you know, my daughter went to college at UND for a semester or two while she was trying to make up her mind what she wanted to be when she grew up. And she
I'm still doing that.
Really? Yeah. Well, I am kind of too, but I'm settling in now that I'm almost retirement age. But she told me that her biggest complaint about living in Grand Forks was how cold it was and how it smelled like potatoes all the time. Because I think they have a
plot there.
Yes, they have a factory there. So guess what they celebrate? Ta-da!
Potatoes.
They have a potato bowl. And it's not just the weekend. It's actually the September 13th through the 18th. So it's like a whole week long celebrating the potatoes. And they have, of course, the University of North Dakota there. So there's lots of young people. And then the Red River Valley potato growing industry. They're working together to have a French fry feed and fireworks and potato pancakes. And who doesn't like potato pancakes?
Oh, they are delicious.
Before going to a parade. And then, of course, a tailgate party and a football game, which I heard tailgate parties are lots of fun. I'm not much of a football fan, but I am learning about the game.
But tailgating is fun.
I know. I'm thinking I should learn more about tailgating than I do about football. So.
Yeah, well, that's your getting together and eating right there.
Totally cool. And some people go all, you know, they go whole hog with that kind of stuff and bring out the grills and they dress up. And it's really kind of looks like fun.
Yeah.
But Grand Forks is like a in the boondocks from where I live, like that's a long ways to go. So I'm going to have to maybe team up with BSC or something.
Well,
like
how about
that.
You just go an hour and a half north of you to Minot for Ooh. Women, Wine, and Wings?
I think that sounds like really more my speed.
Okay.
Like we used to have this thing called Women's Song down around Edgley in Lemoore area. And it was sort of like there were no men around and it was like all women and all crafts and all this good food and all this fun. So this might have to be my next favorite festival. So I'm assuming that the wings are from chickens. And that the wine is hopefully made in North Dakota, but this is at the Dakota Territory Air Museum. And, oh, actually, I'm sorry. There's an air base in Minot. And so the wings are from airplanes.
Yeah.
I hope they aren't going to try to eat those or anything. But so food and drinks and famous aviator-type women's or probably just women in the Air Force in general, which I'm sure there's more now than there was, you know, even 10 years ago. So my brother was an Air Force pilot, so I have a special place in my heart for wings.
A lot of good festivals coming up in September, and always if you need an excuse to get together to have food, well, you could just make one up.
Heck yeah. Call me. I'll see what I can arrange for a farm tour and some food for you.
Sue Balcom joins us once a week to talk about food. Sue, thank you.
Thank you, Ashley.
Next time on The Pulse, batteries are a big deal these days because they power so many aspects of our lives.
You know, even my little kids, they know that batteries make things, make noises, and make pretty colors.
But batteries can quickly become the Achilles heel in something that otherwise works well.
Of course we want longer life and smaller batteries.
The quest to build better batteries.
That's The Pulse, coming up at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 2nd. North Dakotans took many steps to fight the 1918 flu pandemic. Bismarck had a mask mandate for waitresses and other food handlers. Schools and businesses around the state closed, some for months. There was even a vaccine, though it turned out to be useless. A U.S. Public Health Service ad said, coughs and sneezes spread diseases as dangerous as poison gas shells, referring to the poison gas being used in World War I. Bismarck's city health officer issued instructions that included wearing masks, washing hands, keeping teeth clean, and opening windows. Some newspaper ads recommended oranges, lemons, grapefruit, and even raw or cooked onions to prevent or treat the flu. The Jamestown Weekly Alert recommended a treatment that included a good sweating and gargling with antiseptic. Physicians thought heavy rain or cold weather would stop the epidemic. An eccentric North Dakota Supreme Court justice pestered the Attorney General about booze for treating the flu, but at the time, North Dakota had a new law banning liquor being imported into the state. Justice James Robinson wrote, "When a person is taken with the flu, he is as a person bitten by a rattlesnake. He can drink liquor like water until he had had enough, because one poison kills another. Drink till you feel happy. Go to bed and sweat. Take a quinine pill with every two or three swallows of the good medicine. Eat plenty of good steak or roast beef, and then, like a Christian Scientist, you may order the flu to go to the hot place." Attorney General Bill Langer allowed whiskey and brandy to be brought into North Dakota for medicinal purposes, but only registered pharmacists could dole it out. On this date in 1919, the Grand Forks City Health Officer began an anti-spitting campaign in an effort to prevent a new surge of the flu. He prepared signs to post around town and said this was one of the most important measures which could be taken to prevent the disease, as it is largely by promiscuous spitting that it is spread. The pandemic lingered into 1920 and, by one estimate, killed more than 5,100 North Dakotans. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Inside of a theater in Los Angeles, carpenters, painters, and electricians are working fast.
A normal new build for us is anywhere from 3 to 6 months.
And you're having to do this in
10 days.
As the LA Opera gets ready for opening night, how has the pandemic caused major disruptions?
Sounds like this whole production is like an opera itself.
Without a doubt.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, the new short film, Sadie Breaks the Silence. It is the last film that the late filmmaker and former professor of film, Tom Brandau, ever worked on. We visit with his wife, who acted in the film, was the art director, and even made sure the staff was fed and watered. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.